You give Teller from Jerusalem 20 minutes, and he'll give you the education of a lifetime. King of the Storytellers and the Shakespeare of the Torah world, here is Rabbi Hanoch Teller.
Welcome everyone to Teller from Jerusalem, and I'm your host, Hanoch Teller. It is our great honor again to host Rabbi Stephen Weil, who last time had us riveted with his description of the doomsday situation in the Middle East, the proxies of Iran, and what it means for us in Israel, and what it means for the whole world if it doesn't wake up very, very, very soon. I'm going to ask you, Rabbi, to please pick up where we left off and tell us where we go from here.
Rabbi Teller, thank you very much. It's an honor to be on the podcast. And just to spend a 30 seconds to review, look, the Iranian Republican Guard Corps, which is it's the personal army of the imams of the Supreme Ayatollahs, they control 40 to 50% of the economy in Iran. Their job has been to spread the revolution. They have their tentacles on every continent, whether it's the triangle between Brazil, Argentina, and Paraguay, but primarily what they have is they've created six proxies. We talked about them, the Houthis, we talked about the Shia militias in Syria, the Shia militias in Western Iraq, we talked about Hamas and PIJ in Gaza, we've spoken about Hamas and PIJ in Judea and Samaria. And where we left off was the strength and the control that the Hezbollah has and the number of rockets. And what we didn't mention last time is we're confident that they have at least between 1,000 to 2,000 precision-guided missiles. That means they can take out an airport, the Ben-Gurion airport. They could take out the Leviathan gas rig. They could take out the Azraeli towers within 14 inches of accuracy. And they've got again, probably 2,000 of those, maybe more. You know, those estimates are coming from the CIA and from Mossad. That's very dangerous because it's more difficult to take out a precision-guided missile than it is just a rocket with a trajectory. That's number one. Number two is their accuracy is quite significant, to put it mildly. And that's what Israel's facing. And if we defend the most strategic assets, the runways, which we spoke about at the end of last podcast, and I'll use an analogy. The miracle of the Six-Day War. How did Israel, what was God's hand in that? With the exception of 12 airplanes that they left back to defend the country, they took every other aircraft. They flew on radio silence. They flew under radar. And they took out every landing strip, every military landing strip that existed in Egypt, with the exception of Sharm el-Sheikh, where the goal was to land Israeli troops. But everything they took out. What did that accomplish? The most powerful weapon that existed in the Middle East in 1967 was a Soviet MiG jet. And with 500 brand new Soviet MiG jets, not to mention the previous Soviet MiG jets, Egypt should have slaughtered Israel. But when those jets couldn't get off the ground because Israel took out in the first hour and 45 minutes of the war on Monday morning, June 5th, 1967, when they took out those landing strips, it basically deemed those aircraft as impotent. The same fear we have of what Hezbollah could do to the Israeli airstrips. That's number one. And let's assume, which is an optimistic assumption, that Israel's able to defend and ward off against all those rockets on the airstrips. You leave your cities, towns, and villages totally exposed, and you're looking at thousands of fatalities. That's
the great
fear.
There aren't enough iron domes to protect both the military and the civilians.
That's correct.
And the numbers can't be increased?
They've put two new batteries that are on loan from America right now. But in the short run, the numbers can't be increased. You know, Israel is trying to develop this laser system, which is probably 7-8 years away, where they use lasers. The problem is today it's not operational. It only works on a sunny day, number one. Number two is sort of like in America. You need this massive grid to have electric cars. For everybody to have electric cars, you would need a massive grid that we don't have the infrastructure for. Same thing would be for this laser system. So that's a long way of saying, no, we don't have the missile defense to prevent the Hezbollah rockets.
And Israel's relying very heavily on sophisticated technology, when all it needs is a couple missiles to get through, and they cut off Israel at the knees.
Yeah. It's quite scary. They're a serious threat. and you and I have heard, when the former chief of staff, General Kochavi, stepped down after 4 years, he was allowed to do a public interview. You know, that was acceptable. You know, it wasn't something that was a classified briefing. And somebody asked him the question, what happens if the Hezbollah attacks Israel with that massive weaponry? He says, and I'm paraphrasing him, but unlike Hamas, which Israel is fighting with two arms tied behind its back, think about the extreme means that Israel goes to, the 504 unit, which is telling everyone where to go, removing all civilians. The only ones staying back in these areas are people who, number one, are Hamas, or number two, forced human shields that Hamas won't let out. But the large majority of the 2 million civilians in Gaza, they have free movement to go into these areas, to clear out of Khan Yunis, to clear out of Rafiah, to clear before out of Gaza City or Beit Hanun. You don't have that luxury of fighting Hezbollah with two arms tied behind your back, where you'll only strike something where there's no collateral damage and no civilians. We just don't have that luxury. Israel won't exist. They'll obliterate, they'll annihilate Israel. So what happens is, and I'm quoting him now, he said we'd have to send Israel back, I'm sorry, Lebanon back 80 years in time to strike the various places where these missiles are stored and hidden throughout the length and breadth of Lebanon, and do it in a way where you're not looking at 100,000 fatalities in the homeland of Israel. They're just going to have to strike. They're not going to have the luxury of telling people, you've got to clear out this area because we're going to strike. They're going to have to strike wherever the missiles are, which is not what they do in Gaza. And with that being said and done, assuming that America stocks Israel, replenishes Israel so that it can defend itself. That's number one. And number two is, assuming that Israel's successful, you're still looking at a first couple of weeks of massive, massive barrages each and every day coming from Lebanon, something that we've never seen in our life. We've seen missiles come to Israel, but not with that kind of frequency, not with those kind of numbers. That's the challenge. That's the existential threat that comes from the Hezbollah in Lebanon. And it's a very challenging issue. Now, I will say there is, so to speak, one positive. What Hamas, the atrocities of October 7th, and these are inhuman atrocities, and they murdered 1,200 people. It's actually more when you take into account the hostages that are dead in Gaza. But had the Radvan been the first ones to do this to the northern communities, What the Nukba did on October 7th, the elite Nukba units from Hamas, the Radvan, who are those elite units, have been trained to go into Israeli towns, cities, and villages and murder, slaughter, and abduct hostages, it would have been far more significant. There's 5,000 of these Radvan.
In a video released to mark the anniversary of the 2006 Lebanon War, Hezbollah has shown off its most advanced combat unit, the Radwan Force. It showcases not only the Shiite organization's fighting ability, but its eye for propaganda, with visuals that wouldn't look out of place in Hollywood or Call of Duty. While Hezbollah's huge arsenal of missiles is its primary threat towards Israel, cross-border ground attacks are also a card in its hand. The slick promotional content depicts Radwan fighters attacking a mock Israeli border position. Seizing territory in northern Israel is one of the unit's strategic objectives. In the depicted assault, Hezbollah fighters are shown wielding mortars, anti-tank missiles, kamikaze drones, sniper rifles, and heavy machine guns, as well as some more specialized equipment, such as what appears to be a minefield breaching charge. Radwan is believed to number around 2,500 fighters, accounting for about 5% of Hezbollah's total assessed manpower. Its operatives appear to be far more capable than your average Hezbollah fighter, with training provided by the Sabarin Commandos, a battalion within Iran's Al-Quds force. Israeli military intelligence assesses that during wartime, Radwan units would be tasked with cross-border raids aimed at attacking civilian communities and seizing hostages.
And right now as we speak, because Israel quite successfully has been striking areas in southern Lebanon where the terrorists have been shooting mortars and been killing soldiers, civilians with those mortars, anti-tank mortars, they've destroyed, I think, 90 homes out of 116 homes on the kibbutz. But the fact is, Israel evacuated the civilian populations, and Israel sent two-thirds of all of the reservists on October 7th when the call-up started. Only one-third of the reservists was sent to the Gaza Strip, to the Gaza border at the time. The real threat, the real fear, was the Hezbollah joining in. That's why two-thirds of the soldiers were sent to the northern border.
People who live along Israel's border with Lebanon, which is about 11 miles that way, are used to tensions since there's been a history of clashes with Lebanon's Hezbollah, most notably a month-long war in 2006. Yesterday, 28 communities within around 1 mile of the border with Lebanon were ordered to evacuate. And we spoke to members of one of those communities today. Many said they had already left after the attacks on southern Israel put people in the north on high alert at kibbutzes and other communities in this area. And since then, Hezbollah and Israel have exchanged brief rocket fire. An anti-tank missile fired by Hezbollah hit an Israeli village on Sunday, killing one person and injuring three others. And the Israeli military said it killed four militants wearing explosive vests who were trying to cross the border into Israel. Now, the Israeli military has sent troop reinforcements to the northern border. Of the roughly 350,000 Israeli reserve soldiers being mobilized across the country in response to the October 7th attack by Hamas, a large portion are being sent to this area.
By evacuating all of these civilians, we're talking probably close to over 100,000 civilians, maybe more. On the one hand, we've saved their lives. On the other hand, they're living, you know, as refugees for the last 80-some days, as Rabbi Teller, you mentioned. What it does is it would take a huge toll on fatalities of soldiers. It would keep the civilians from being abducted or slaughtered in their own homes. That's what it's done. And unlike the southern border, the Gaza area, where you're going to have many of these people returning to the scene of the crime, many of these people returning to the very area where they saw the atrocities, they survived the atrocities because they want to rebuild Israel and they want to rebuild the, what we call the Western Negev section of Israel. I don't know that anybody wants to return to the northern border when you've got the Radvan, you know, across the border, when you've got all those missiles and rockets aimed at you across the border. And it's a very different situation. And who knows what's going to happen on that northern border. But it's very, very fragile. It's very challenging, and that's an understatement, because you're looking at potentially a loss of thousands and thousands of civilian and soldier lives. That's what we're looking at. And it will make what happened on the southern border very, very insignificant relative to the potential loss of lives and loss of property and damage that you could see with a northern war. And again, I'm not here to be a doomsday person. I'm here to lay out the reality and the facts of what we're facing.
So what are people thinking? In other words, everybody is anxious to go back to their homes, but like you said, they're afraid to go back. So the only alternative they would seem to be would be to eliminate Hezbollah. By no means a piece of cake.
The Hezbollah has sent over 1,000 rockets into Israel and killed 12 people, injured numbers of people, done huge damage to property. Under any other circumstances, that's a war. It's a war under any other circumstances. Israel has limited it. Israel's taken out over 120 of the Radvan. They've also taken out some strategic locations in southern Lebanon. But they've limited it because they're fighting a war, most challenging urban war in history, because they're fighting the most densely populated place in the globe, which is the Gaza Strip. And until Israel finishes this phase of the war, we're now here on December 26th recording this, you know, we could be looking at another month, another 6 weeks of this phase of the war. You know, you don't necessarily want to have as many divisions in Gaza as you do now. You'd like to be able to free up some of those divisions for a war in the north. If Hezbollah does not stop, if Hezbollah does not abide by UN Resolution 1701, which means there is no Hezbollah south of the Litani River.
15 years ago, Israel fought a war with Hezbollah. The war was instigated by Hezbollah after its leaders made the calculated decision to fire rockets and anti-tank missiles into Israel. Hezbollah militants infiltrated into Israel and attacked IDF soldiers, killing five and kidnapping two of their bodies. For over 30 days, Hezbollah terrorists fired rockets at Israeli cities, towns, civilians, and infrastructure. In response, the IDF targeted Hezbollah military targets and militants who purposefully embedded themselves behind the civilian population in Lebanon, using them as human shields. Resolution 1701 was passed by the United Nations Security Council at the end of the conflict. It included a list of steps that Lebanon should take to exercise its authority over its territory and oust Hezbollah, as well as measures to avoid the reignition of hostilities.
Hezbollah may choose the option of saying, you know, look at what they did in Gaza, and if America will replenish their supply and their stock, they could do the same thing to us, and we could lose all of our power because, as we said, Lebanon could turn into a parking lot. Lebanon could be sent back 70, 80 years. Do we really want to do this? So that's option number one, is that Hezbollah backs down. How they're going to spin that, I'm not sure, because in the Islamic world, you know, your strength or your perceived strength is everything. That's number one. Number two is we could be facing an all-out war. And I don't know which way it's going to go.
In our earlier podcast, you mentioned that really what's giving the green light to America is Saudi Arabia, Jordan, the Emirati countries. Are they not pressuring America now to neutralize the Hezbollah in Lebanon?
I believe they are. Their greatest fear is Iran. Iran right now, its greatest asset, because Iran hasn't yet developed the capability of delivering a nuclear bomb. They're very close to having a nuclear bomb, but they don't have a delivery system as far as we know. Their greatest asset is the Hezbollah. Not only because they control Lebanon, they control the ports of Tyre and Beirut and Sidon, but also because Hezbollah has assets all over the world, all over the globe. They've got terrorist networks. And if Iran loses that asset, it's much more significant and much more crucial to Iran than the Hamas. The Hamas is important, but nowhere near as important to Iran as the Hezbollah. So the question is, will Iran say back down? We don't know the answer to that. That's the question. Because I can tell you this, from a Sunni Arab perspective, the elimination of Hezbollah is essential, is crucial to stability in the Middle East and to weakening Iran. It's very crucial to them, as much as it is to us, as much as it is to the Western world. And I just want to, if I could, for a minute, I want to go in a different direction. Again, what you don't see in academia, what you don't see in the journalistic community, this is not about Israel. It's not about, like they spin it, the Al-Quds, we have to liberate Jerusalem because they're going to take over the Temple Mount, they're going to take over the Shrine of Omar and the Mosque of, it's just baloney. It's not about that. That's what they spin it. It's about the domination, first and foremost, of Sunni Islam, controlling Mecca, Medina, the Saudi Arabian oil fields, the Emirati gas fields. That's number one. But number two is, it's ultimately about domination of the world. What they call the Great Satan. So the Great Satan is not just America. America is the poster child for the Great Satan.
From Tehran, he would incite Iranians and Muslims around the world to oppose the Great Satan, America. And America reciprocated this favor by imposing draconian sanctions on Iran and by isolating the country.
The Great Satan is Western civilization. It's Christian Europe. That's the ultimate goal. Goal number one is domination of Sunni Islam. Goal number two is the domination of Western civilization. But what is standing in their way? The Jews. What's standing in their way? The IDF. What's standing in their way? Tiny little Israel, who they know isn't so tiny and isn't so little. It's tiny and little geographically. It's tiny and little population-wise. But it's the one thing standing in their way from having this hegemonic Shia caliphate from the Arabian Sea to the Mediterranean. That's what's standing in their way. And that's why in the world doesn't appreciate this. You know, Vladimir Lenin used this term. I don't think he created it, but he borrowed the term called useful idiots.
Vladimir Lenin is said to have called communist sympathizers in America useful idiots. The phrase refers to people like New York Times reporter Lincoln Steffens, who traveled to the Soviet Union shortly after the revolution and claimed, quote, "I have seen the future and it works." Or New York Times reporter Walter Duranty, I'm seeing a trend here, New York Times reporter Walter Duranty, who won the Pulitzer Prize for publishing Stalin's propaganda denying the Holodomor that starved to death 7.5 million people.
You've got the heads of universities, you've got the humanities professors, you've got the students all over the world protesting. Those are Shia Islam's useful idiots. Okay? These very people would be annihilated in a Shia hegemonic caliphate. These very people, at best, would be oppressed, turned into slavery, more likely annihilated because of their beliefs. But what happens? They use these idiots the same way that the communists use the idiots to take over from the Romanovs, to take over from the Tsars. And that they just don't get. Because, again, facts don't matter.
The world seemed to wake up to ISIS when they wanted to make a caliphate. And they did all they could to prevent it. Why is there not that awareness over here?
That is a great question. And I think the question is stronger than my answers. I mean, one answer is anti-Semitism. That's one answer. Another answer is that there's been a situation where Israel has been defined as the oppressor, or the Palestinians the oppressed. Even though we know from population numbers, we know from tactics, Israel by far is the oppressed. Israel is the David, not the Goliath, but that's not how it's been spun. So if you work in simplistic categories, Israel is the oppressor. They're the Goliath and the Palestinians are the David. That's possibility number one. And I think a combination of that and anti-Semitism. Not latent, but acute anti-Semitism. But your question is such a rational, logical question, and the answer should be so obvious, but it's not. These are all societies that hate gays. These are all societies that oppress women. But that doesn't matter. You know? The fact that Palestinian gays find refuge in Tel Aviv, the fact that you've got Muslim women serving as Supreme Court justices in Israel, that the Muslims make up 20% of the population in Israel, but yet they're one-third of all medical students, none of that matters. That it's the only place in the Middle East where a female Muslim can get a degree as a physician or have a position in high tech, none of that matters to these people. The facts don't matter.
And there's not a leader out there? I mean, I'm afraid I know the answer. Some Churchillian leader out there who's recognizing what this is going to play on the world stage.
People like Nikki Haley get it. People like Mike Pompeo get it.
Right.
But they're the minority. You know, and people, I think not only them, I think Mike Pence gets it. You know, again, these are certain people who see trends in the world who are students of history, the way Churchill was a student of history. But the average person, including the average academician, has no ability. We see
like Barack Obama. Yeah.
Just
intelligent person who did everything Iraq a man wanted.
Yeah, had no ability to read history. I mean, look at us. The Jews, we have this principle in Deuteronomy, Zechor Yemos Olam Binu Shnos Dor Vador. We're challenged by God to learn from history, to analyze history. Because the human condition and human personality doesn't change, and to learn. And that's why we're so sensitive, because we're coming with 4,000 years of history, which we have the ability to take that and use it to shape our future and to define our destiny. That's not necessarily something that the average person on the globe sees the world in historical categories. They don't see it in categories of destiny either. And they're not working off of that principle in Deuteronomy. And unfortunately, because of that, they don't understand that the 21st century, will the 21st century be defined by justice, by morality, by principles of basic humanity, the basic principles that God gave us, you know, of human dignity? Is that how we're going to define the 21st century? Is the 21st century going to be a century of oppression, of vitriolic hate, of just domination of innocent human beings? Is that what it's going to be? is it going to be defined by terror reigning supreme? And that's a problem. And they don't understand the ultimate goal, the great Satan of Western civilization, not just America. America, Western civilization, Christian Europe, that's what's at stake. This is not about a squabble between Hamas and Israel. It's something much greater than that. And by the way, you don't have to believe me. Just listen to the Supreme Ayatollahs over the last 30 years. Whether it's Khamenei, who's the Ayatollah now, whether it's the original Ayatollah Khomeini, listen to what they're saying. You know, our politicians very often lie because they have to get elected. So they say things that people want to hear. Those people don't have to get elected. In Persia, there's no democracy there. They can say what they want because, you know, look, Hitler, he laid out the game plan in Mein Kampf. The world just didn't believe them. These people have laid out the game plan for 30 years.
Hermann Rauschning, who was his personal biographer, said, no one was ever clearer about his intentions than Hitler himself. He was as clear and explicit as could be of what he intended to do. And our time has lapsed, so, and I don't want to leave it now here either. I'd love to appeal for yet another podcast, but at least you're giving us the rational questions that we can think about, hopefully we can act about.
This is about the 21st century, and this is ultimately about their attempt to dominate not just Sunni Islam, but to dominate the civilized world, what they call the Great Satan. And we should not fool ourselves, and we shouldn't be naive about what's at stake.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Weil. We are so indebted to you for all your insight and your analysis, which is eye-opening, and I hope we can take some action based on kernel of what you've told us. Thank you so very much. It's an honor to have you.
It's an honor to be here.
Thanks for listening to Teller from Jerusalem, where this series takes an intelligent and thought-provoking look at the past in order to acquire a perspective on the present. Spread knowledge by giving us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe. Join us next time for a brand new episode, and be sure to visit tellerfromjerusalem.com, where you can find more details about the show and other useful information. Check out the site store, and just by inserting the TFJ code, you receive an additional 10% discount off the already very reduced prices of all Chanoch Teller products, books, lectures, and documentaries. And remember, don't forget, you can get Teller from Jerusalem on any podcast platform or go to tellerfromjerusalem.com.